from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Hey, remember those days pre-COVID when we heard the cry, let's do lunch? Well, hey, let's do lunch. You were invited to 30 Laps lunch date with this week's motormouth, the great British driver, Derek Bell. No relation to Alexander Graham, or Taco, or Tinker, for that matter. He was a very fast Bell, and he's at lunch with us. So, pass the mustard, Derek. And on our way home from lunch, we'll take the limo. Take me back to the limo, Jeeves. The limo, what is it? And what were the great ones? Was it the Beast? Or perhaps that pink Hummer? Let's get carried away and find out. This week, in 30 Laps. So, lunch with Derek Bell. This is from the English Motorsport magazine, and it was written in 2009 by Simon Taylor. He's the English gentleman who scored more sports car wins than anyone even he can remember, although no one will ever forget his record at Le Mans and Daytona. Derek Bell is quintessentially an Englishman. He was raised and raced with enormous success in the USA, where he was a popular figure. His wife, Misty, is American, and he spends much of the year at his waterside house in Boca Raton, Florida. Florida! Many of his greatest victories were scored in German cars, and he's been a works driver at the most famous Italian team of all. But there's always been something frightfully British about his approach to life, which mixes professionalism and a fierce will to win with an old-fashioned belief in friendly good manners towards teammates, fellow competitors, and spectators. So it's appropriate that we meet in his 17th century thatched house on the Sussex coast. Hard by the family farm where he grew up. He still retains 60 acres around it. Then we walk across the nature reserve of Pagham Harbour and along the shoreline to the crab and lobster Sydenham, where we sit in the sunny garden eating a stew of locally caught fish and quaffing good English beer. Yum. Even Derek has lost count of how many sports car races he's won, although 5 Le Mans 24-hour, 3 Daytona 24-hour, and 2 World Drivers' Championships will do for starters. His career lasted 46 years, so far. Last season, at the age of 66, he was running his umpteenth Daytona, only for his Riley Pontiac to fail before his first stint. Ask him if he's retired yet, and he says he probably has. Then moments later, he mentions in passing a Porsche 917 he's racing at the Laguna Seca this month, and his likely rides at the Goodwood Festival. After almost half a century of racing, a life chock full of different tracks, teams, personalities and happenings, good and bad, any chat with Derek can only scratch the surface. We spend more than 4 hours over lunch. We walk back to his house, sit in the late afternoon sunshine by a swimming pool, and the stories keep coming. Finally, I have to take my leave, and driving back to London, I remember more dramas and more people and more races that we didn't even get to. As a teenager at agricultural college, Derek scraped up the funds to take a few Jim Russell racing drivers' school lessons at Snetterton, one at a time, driving to Norfolk in his side valve Morris Minor. Jim Russell himself marked him out as a man to watch. Later he bought a Lotus 7 with a friend and won his first race at Goodwood. It was a handicap in teeming rain, and I started off with lots of much faster cars behind me, like Hugh Dibley's Brabham BT8, and I waited for them to come screaming past, but they all spun off. In 1965 came his first single-seater, an elderly Lotus 22-31, which brought some success in club races, and for 1966, helped by his stepfather Bernard, the Colonel Hender, he decided on a serious F3 campaign in Europe. "The old man was marvellous," he said. "Gave farming a rest for a bit. You can always come back to it when you're 40, but you can't always go motor racing when you're 40. As it turned out, I was 40 when I won Le Mans for the third time." Derek's first choice of an F3 car was a Lotus 41, and it was a mistake. It was never competitive, and trying to beat the Brabhams, he had several accidents. So, for 1967, he joined Peter Westbury and Mac Daghorn in a three-car Brabham team and scored some excellent results, including a win at Zolder, a third at Monaco, and a second at Albi, half a length behind the Matra of local hero Henry Pescarolo. After that, the only way forward was Formula 2. The old man had paid for 3 years of F3 and very reasonably said I had to find the money from now on. I wrote hundreds of letters to prospective sponsors, and I got one reply from Avis, who sent me a badge saying, "We try harder." In the end, the only option was the NatWest at Bognor Regis. Amazingly, they lent me 10,000 quid. But the old man had put up the farm as guarantee. So, armed with a Brabham BT23 and his lucky mechanic Ray Wardell and a truck with Church Farm Racing painted on the side, Derek embarked on his European Formula 2 season.
"Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing."
Well, after nearly 80 shows, I figure Sir Bob should make an appearance somewhere along the time. And the times definitely were a-changing for Derek. The first race I actually started was Hockenheim. I qualified fifth on the Saturday, went back to the hotel in Speyer, and found myself having a cup of tea with two of my heroes, Jimmy Clark and Graham Hill. They'd both been having problems with the Team Lotus 48s. Jimmy qualified 7th, Graham 15th. And Jimmy said, "Tomorrow, when you lap me, don't get too close." I couldn't believe it. My hero saying that to me before my first F2 race. But he said, "I've got a really bad misfire and they can't seem to fix it." Next day it was wet, cold and miserable. Jimmy and Graham gave me a lift to the track and dropped me off in the paddock. I never saw Jimmy again. The race was a two-parter and I finished 4th in part 1 ahead of Piers Courage. I think Jimmy was lying 8th when he crashed. I knew nothing about it until I saw his mechanic, Becky Sims, walking through the paddock holding one of Jimmy's shoes. And then the word went round. The generally accepted view was that he went off because of a puncture. But my own theory is a misfire did it. You took that long, fast corner at 150 mile an hour. But it wasn't a critical place. Even in the wet, we were going through it to abreast. But if the engine cut out suddenly, mid-corner, and you corrected, and then it cut in again, that would send you off into the trees. Years later, I talked to Beaky about it. And he said, "Yeah, we did have a problem with the fuel injection metering unit that day." We were all pretty shattered by Jimmy's death. We didn't seem to be able to get through a month in those days without somebody getting slaughtered somewhere. as well as the chaps at the top like Jimmy, there were kids dying in Formula 3 that no one ever heard about. At one F3 race at Caserta in Italy, three people died in an 11-car pileup. Guillermo Russo, Bette Fehr, and Romano Padomi. Nobody remembers those names now. 3 weeks later, we were in Denmark at De Schlurdering, and Doug Revson, Pete's brother, was killed. And in Formula 2, 3 months after Jimmy's accident, Chris Lambert was killed at Zandvoort when Clay Regazzoni collided with him. I'd known Chris since Formula 3 days. He wore glasses and didn't look like a racing driver. He looked more like one of those boys at school who always get everything wrong. But in fact, he was brilliantly fast. A week after Hockenheim, I was third at Thruxton behind Jochen Rindt and Jean-Pierre Beltoise, and third again at Eccelsbrennen on the bumpy Nuremberger Schutzschleife. That's the bumpy track on runs around the outside of it, for those who aren't aware of it. So Formula 2 was going well for me. I realised just how well when I was summoned to Maranello. I had a meeting with Enzo Ferrari. We walked across the road to the Cavallino restaurant and had lunch. That was special. Michael Schumacher might have won five world championships for Ferrari, but he never had lunch with Enzo. Then came the test at Monza in the Formula 2 Dino. I was run with several Italian drivers, including Tino Brambilla and Marco Cassoni, and fortunately, I was quicker than both of them. So Ferrari produced a contract. But I didn't sign it then. I wanted to keep my options open. But they entered me for the Formula 2 Monza Lotteria, and I put it on pole. In the race, I was coming out of the Parabolica in the middle of a huge slipstreaming group when, for suddenly no reason, my car spun. There was a huge pileup. It rode off three of the four Dinos in the race. Jean-Pierre Jussard was thrown out of his Techno and was quite badly hurt. I hadn't signed any contract. Oh boy, I went home miserably, thinking that was it. But Ferrari got hold of the film of the accident, and they reckoned I was hit from behind. Anyway, they didn't blame me. Next time I was at Maranello, Franco Gozzi came over and said, "El Comodatore was pleased with your pole position," and he gave me a bonus check. I'd also been approached by Cooper, who tested me in one of their Maserati-powered Formula One cars at Silverstone. I thought it was a bit of a lorry, but their chap, Major Owens, who ran the team for John Cooper, summoned me. An F1 contract at last. I thought, expecting a retainer of at least £10,000. As Owens droned on about how hard times were in Formula One, I modified my expectations down to £5,000, then £1,000. When he finally got round to making me this offer, he proposed a 3-year contract with a retainer of £5. For once in my life, I was rendered speechless. So, of course, I signed for Ferrari. The deal was £250 per Formula 2 race, and if they asked me to do a Formula 1 race, it would be £500. I did more F2 races for them that season, and I went to Modena for an F1 test. The old 3/4 mile track, all walls and bushes, and it was raining, all wet weather tyres on the track coming up from the German Grand Prix, so I had to do it on intermediates. That's a between wet and dry tyre, folks. On the outside of turn one, there was Enzo Ferrari sitting in his 250 GT2 plus 2 watching from behind those dark glasses. Mario Forglieri leaned into the cockpit and said to me, "You crash it and it's the last time you're in a red car." There were puddles down at the S's, but the car felt simply wonderful and the test went pretty well. So they sent three cars to Alton Park for the World Gold Cup. Chris Amon, Jackie X, and me. I ran fifth until the gearbox packed it in. 3 weeks later, I was summoned to Monza, my first Grand Prix in a Ferrari in Italy. It was 4 short years since that Goodwood clubby run in the Lotus 7.
For you, babe, I couldn't find the door, couldn't even see the floor. I'd be sad and blue if not for you.
There's old Derek whistling "If Not For You" to Enzo Ferrari. But back to the story. I qualified on the third row with Jackie Stewart and Denny Holm, half a second slower than my teammate, Jackie X. The car had a rear wing that moved hydraulically when you hit the brake pedal, with a manual override switch. But after five laps, the engine went and I had to park it. I was trudging back to the pits when I beheld the shocking sight of my teammate, Chris Amon, flying over the barriers and into the trees. I was sure he'd been killed, and on top of the other casualties that year, I began to feel I should get out of this damn racing business. But back at the pits, they told me Chris was okay, so I forgot all about it. I did a couple more GPs for Ferrari, and that winter Chris and I drove a 2.4-litre versions of the Dino in the Tasman series. It was seven lovely weeks, Chris, me, Jochen and Graham in the Lotuses, Piers, Frank Gardner, and I had good races. Tom Wheatcroft was down there looking for cars to buy for his collection. "Any time you need my help, lad," he said, "you give me a call." For those that don't know, the Tasman series was run in Australia and New Zealand in the off Formula One season, and all the famous drivers came down to great tracks in Australia and New Zealand and raced each other. It was great fun. I went to quite a few. But I digress. Well, no, not really. I guess that had a fair bit to do with that. Anyway, back to the story. My Ferrari contract covered 1969. But that was their disastrous year, crippled by strikes and financial problems. In Formula One, they effectively only ran one car, and they more or less pulled out of Formula Two by mid-season. The only F1 race I did was the Daily Express at Silverstone, when it poured with rain, and our Firestones were hopeless. I finished ninth. Chris was 10th. Ferrari released me to drive four-wheel drive McLaren in the British Grand Prix, but that was pretty unmanageable and broke its suspension just a few laps into the race. 12 months from his fairy tale signing for Ferrari, Derek's career appeared to be beached. It was Tom Wheatcroft who came to his rescue. We did the Tasman series in 1970 with his Brabham, using a whacked-out old 2.5 DVF we'd bought from Lotus. The engine was rebuilt as a 3-litre and we did the Belgian Grand Prix, but the gear change broke on the warm-up lap. Then John Surtees offered me a drive at Watkins Glen if I could only supply an engine. Tom lent me the same old DFV, and even though I had to slow towards the end with terrible transmission vibration, I was 6th, the only F1 point I ever got. But I also persuaded Tom to do an F2 season with the new BT30, run from the Church Farm and Mike Earle, and we nearly won the 1970 European Championship. I won Barcelona, was third to Stewart and Rent at Thruxton. It restored my confidence. I still wanted to do Formula One, of course, and Tom and I went to see John Surtees. But Rolf Stommenellen, got there first with Ford Germany money. And all John could offer me was an F5000, which I thought would be a step back. I drove Tom's March 701 in the Argentine Grand Prix, got it up to third before the old engine broke down again. And the Cuesta GP in the US with Frank Williams' March, the suspension broke. But it was a race that year at Spa which set Derek's career on a new course. Belgian Ferrari importer Jacques Swatters asked him to drive a Ferrari 512S in the Spa 1000-kilometre race. He'd never been to Spa before, but even though Derek's co-driver, Hugh de Fulant, was considerably slower, they finished eighth behind the Porsche 917s and the works Ferraris, despite the car catching fire during a refuelling stop. I couldn't get out because the inside door wire had broken. A mechanic smashed the window with a fire extinguisher and he got me out. They put the fire out, I got back in and carried on with singed eyebrows and a scorched face. Although Derek thought of himself purely as a single-seater driver at this point, Spa opened his eyes to the possibility of sports car racing. I was going to drive the yellow 512 at Le Mans as well, but Ferrari offered me a works drive with Ronnie Pedersen. Jacques told me to take it, even though I felt I owed Ferrari nothing after the way they'd dried up on me in 1969. Well, it was my first Le Mans. All the reports and all the official sheets said I crashed, but I didn't. What happened was I was leading a group up to the White House. Three 512s. Me, Regazzoni, and Mike Parks, all doing 170 mile an hour. We came upon the Rhein Weasel going slowly in his Filippinetti 512. I whistled through the gap on two wheels, and in my mirror I saw flames and carnage as Regazzoni had hit Weasel, and Parks ploughed into it too. I carried on, and about a minute later my engine blew on the Milsaan Strait. Four 102s out of the race all at once. And of course everybody assumed I'd been in the accident too. After the race I stayed on at Le Mans for several months to work on the Steve McQueen film. My first wife Pam and my children Justin and Melanie joined me, and for a while we shared a house with Steve. I was a stand-in for one of the actors, driving a 512 Ferrari along with Mike Parks, Richard Atwood and David Piper. They were in Porsche 917s, plus Joe Siffert, Vic Elford. It was quite a gang. We got $100 a day and $200 a day if it was dangerous. We had to drive fast to make it look right. David Piper lost a leg and I got a bad facial burn when the Ferrari caught fire. So it was certainly dangerous. At weekends, I'd go off and race my Wheatcroft Formula 2 car. When my mechanic came through with the Brabham, I said to Steve, "Have a go." He jumped in and enjoyed himself doing laps of the Bugatti circuit. We all got on well because Steve, wanted to be a racing driver, and none of us wanted to be movie actors, so we weren't trying to climb on his shoulders. He was a brave guy. Before the insurance company stopped him, he was driving too. Once we were doing a sequence, me in the 512, Steve in a 917, and Seppi in a 917. We went through the White House at 160 mile an hour, nose to tail, with Steve trapped between Seppi and me so he couldn't lift off. When he got to the end of the shot and climbed out, Steve was pretty shaken up, but he was smiling. Another time, Seppi and I came through the White House flat out and some idiot was lying on his stomach in the middle of the track with a camera. We were furious and complained to the director, John Sturgis. Turned out it was Steve. He was just trying to get a better shot. After I got burned, I did no more filming. But then John Wire came on the phone wanting me to test a JW Porsche 917 at Goodwood. There were three of us, Peter Gethin, Ronnie Pedersen, and me, and somehow I got the drive. The 917 felt hugely powerful, but it's so easy, so light and nimble. This was 1970, remember, when they'd sorted out the early handling problems. By comparison, the Ferrari 512S was like driving a lumber truck, although the later 512M was much better. So for 1971, I raced the 917 paired with Joe Seppi Siffert, Pedro Rodriguez and Jackie Oliver were in the other JW car. Seppi and Pedro in the same team, what a pair. But but they were both killed that same year. It was dreadful. So many people died in those days. It was a part of the job description, going to funerals. Seppi was dynamic, a real street fighter. Of all the guys racing today, I think Dave Brabham is most like him. I'm so pleased David won Le Mans this year. With Seppi, I was a new boy, and he seemed happy with me. We won the first time out at Buenos Aires and went on to have a good season, helping Porsche win the world championship. Seppi was very relaxed out of the car, never wanted to go testing. Pedro was more disciplined, but he could charge even harder than Seppi. Of course, they both desperately wanted to beat each other. When I got pole at Spa that year, 3 seconds quicker than Ix's Ferrari, Pedro said, "Derek, I think it's time you drive with me." When Pedro was killed, I moved over to the number one car. With John Wire, it was like being at school. With him as the strict headmaster, always calling you by your surname. He had all his drivers down to a T, and we all respected him. It was Frank Gardner who called him the death ray because of the way he looked at you if you displeased him. But he also had a wonderfully dry, sardonic wit. I remember going to the factory one day, and I was wearing a pink shirt and jeans. "Ah, Bell, a riot of colour again, I see." David York looked after the drivers, and he was excellent, very clear and decisive. But for 1972, David moved to Martini and to advise them on how to go about setting up a Formula One car. It was his idea for them to sponsor Brabham, and if it had come off, I would have been number two to Carlos Reutemann. But Martini's link with Brabham didn't happen for 3 more years, because Luciano Pedrazzani persuaded Count Gregorio Rossi that he should back an all-Italian car. This was the disastrous Flat 12 Tecno, and I ended up driving it, trying to qualify for its first Grand Prix at Clermont-Ferrand. The handling was dreadful, and they discovered that 4 of the 9 bolts holding the chassis to the back of the Monaco frame had broken. So the car was bending in the middle. I only started 2 GPs with it. Both times the engine blew. It was a useless shitbox. Apart from a few unhappy outings with Surtees in 1974, that spelt the end of Derek's Formula One ambitions. And that's where we'll end this week. We're running out of time, so we'll continue with Lunch with Derek next week and finish this wonderful story. He was there when all the history was happening around him. Of course, he was part of that motoring history of those great days himself. We'll go back to Lunch with Derek next week. Until then, bye for now.